As I introduce Malcolm, this is the time of year to remind everybody that expressions of love for the state of Israel are critical at this time. And there is a parade, a Celebrate Israel parade, going on up Fifth Avenue on June the 5th. And it may seem trivial in comparison to some of the news items we're going to discuss during the weekly update. But I'll start with this because I think it is vital, especially now, that everybody come out whenever there's a public expression of love for Israel. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Public expressions of love for Israel is something that everyone should make every strongest effort to participate in, right?
Absolutely. And when is it more important than now? One needs only look at the headlines after the glow has worn off of Netanyahu's triumphal visit to the Congress, and you see that not only the expected New York Times from the very beginning smashing him and minimizing what he's done and actually trying to turn it into a negative, but even some of our Jewish publications doing the same, and the community really has to show the people of Israel and to show the Congress that we are at least as fervent in our support as they are.
I'm so happy you went in that direction. For a moment, I thought you were going to turn to the foreign press and the European press that's been following the President of the United States so closely this week, obviously. But yes, members of the Jewish media are out there with the points of view that you're pointing out. And I don't know, I think there has to be real second guessing, a little bit of a 2020 hindsight, and realize that that may not be the best thing at this time.
I see the editor of the Forward goes to the one of the most anti-Israel papers in the world, The Guardian, and writes a critical piece or makes critical comments. If you look at the headlines of some of the papers, the Jewish Week, others, I mean, it's not conceivable what's happened to us. And I just saw it last night, so it's really very... It's astonishing that Haaretz does it and tries to whip up the fervor against Netanyahu and the internal politics. That's one thing. You got to think of the price that we pay when you write these headlines. You know, there are several polls. Number one, it showed Netanyahu went up to 33 seats versus Livni 22.
Right.
That's a bump. That's temporary. I know these things come, and, you know, once it's off the screen, and that there will be responsibilities and he'll be judged by the follow-up, et cetera. But if you look at where the American people were, that two-thirds say that a Palestinian state in the West Bank will attack Israel, that 80% say Israel's concern is not irrational, but very rational. I mean, you look at the numbers down the line, and if I can, I sat in the executive gallery with Mrs. Netanyahu during the speech, and I kept thinking, this is a great country. You know, we all criticize, and and I know that people worry that the day, our weekly briefing is always going to tell them the challenges and the problems and things, which, of course, is what headlines are about and what the news is about. But it was time, I think, to step back and to look at what was going on there. It could not happen in any other country, maybe not even in the Knesset, but certainly not in any other country, that across the aisle, Republicans and Democrats were waiting for the opportunity to embrace Israel in vocal ways, in physical ways, getting up dozens of times. At some points, I wasn't even sure why they got up at that point, but it was because they wanted to demonstrate. And the truth is, they got up at the right messages, and they were critical messages. And it wasn't that Republicans led or Democrats led. I watched. There were maybe a half a dozen people who appeared to be hesitant sometimes and in getting up. But overall, when a guy is interrupted as many times as he was by applause and even more by standing ovations, it was a message that here is the elected representative body of the most powerful country in the world making a statement to the world. And the message shouldn't be lost, that we sometimes have to show hakaras hatov, we have to show our appreciation, our recognition, and what kind of a demonstration it was. I met with many of the members afterwards because we were the first ones out, and I saw the vice president and others who were raving about the speech, but also there was almost a glow at it on the part of many. Senator Gillibrand, who was telling me about how important it was that he gave the background, she said, people don't know. We assume people know.
Yeah,
know.
That's so true. Very. Not only are your words appropriate in context of what happened this week, even more appropriate as the United States gets set to commemorate Memorial Day. And we remember those who have fallen in order for all of us to enjoy what you just described. But we have to go backwards a moment, Malcolm. We got to go back to last Friday. So much has happened, obviously, in the congressional or the speech of the joint session of Congress was the centerpiece as far as we are concerned. But we must go back to last Friday. Would you, in fact, assess the situation at the White House that the Prime Minister showed up the President of the United States, and did he mean to do that?
Well, I would hope that he doesn't show him up, because this is a long-term relationship and one that we have to maintain and sustain and nourish. The relationship with the United States and Israel, I think many people came to understand things that you and I have talked about here when, as you know, I'm sure, and get the same emails as I do, why do we cut off the $3 billion? Why do we tell America to take it, and et cetera? What they learned this week is how intense the relationship, how widespread. When they heard about all of the military areas that Netanyahu and others pointed out, members of Congress pointed out, the president pointed out.
Intelligence help, right?
And intelligence in, you know, there's Operation Cobra that we've talked about, but there was also a Juniper Cobra. And then Malcolm,
did he embarrass the president or not? I need to know this answer.
Well, I'm going to come to it.
Okay.
I will come to it, but I don't want to lose the thought, because I may not come back to it. You know, at my age, you don't retain it necessarily. Because yesterday they put online another operation from the Juniper series, and people don't know, you know, that the president had ordered 60 jets to fly together over the Red Sea, where they did exercises with Israeli jets, practicing bombing runs and other things, and I'll let everybody conclude what they want from that.
Right.
But the fact that it's taking place, and nobody writes it, and again, you won't see that on a headline on the same place as we were talking about, but it is, to me, an important message that while whatever the tensions were, we lost sight of the overwhelming areas of agreement. And even on the Palestinian issue, from non-militarized and all the other things that were raised. So the Prime Minister...
Well, in light of what you're saying, then he really blew it Friday morning, or Friday afternoon, whenever it was exactly in the White House, because he should have emphasized that instead of embarrassing the president.
Well, there are many people who believe he should have emphasized the positives on that opportunity, or, you know, when you move up in your chair, body language counts a lot in these situations, and clearly the president's body language and face said a lot, and Netanyahu's intensity. I think that he was very upset by the inclusion of the sentence about 1967, because their understanding was that it would not be included. It was done at the last minute. He heard about it when he was on a plane. He issued a statement from the plane that got misinterpreted, because they said in the media all day Friday that the Prime Minister said on his plane that that the President's position was indefensible, when he said was that the borders that the President mentioned were indefensible. That's a big difference.
Right.
And I think the Prime Minister wanted to use this opportunity to essentially put down the markers and to say that look at the context, look at what we're doing. How you do it, all those things are stuff that will be analyzed for a long time to come. The fact is that the President then went before AIPAC and reviewed the whole speech, tried to clarify the things that he said, reiterated much of what he had said. So... and the Prime Minister over Shabbos, they issued statements after Shabbos, you know, ameliorating it, trying to put a cork on the tensions.
It has
a long-term carryover, and that's not something anybody wants.
First of all, I thought that if the President was not offended to the degree that the media and everyone thought he was, that he would have somehow made light of it on Sunday morning during the 11 a.m. AIPAC speech. But that notwithstanding, because you don't always have to have, you know, humor to prove one way or the other. But you know what's funny? And I keep asking you this question about whether he was embarrassing him or not. I saw what Netanyahu said. I watched it. And it didn't strike me the way it struck everybody else. I didn't think it was embarrassing to the president. I didn't think he was, you know, sitting there doing anything inappropriate. Now, everybody disagrees with me, from the media, from the Jewish community. Everybody disagrees. I mean, the whole Shabbos, I'm hearing how Bibi destroyed Obama. I didn't see it that way. So now I ask you one more time, and excuse me for belaboring the point. If you spoke to Barack Obama and he was honest, was he embarrassed by Netanyahu on Friday?
I don't know whether he felt embarrassed. Would he been upset? I think he was. Remember, we're talking about this coming into the political silly season, so everything has ramifications in terms of Jewish vote, others vote. Remember, Israel, as was demonstrated in the Congress, has broad support in the United States. It was clear this was not Jewish support. You know, the Jewish members of Congress,
right,
had they all jumped up and applauded, would still not have made a wave. But it's across the board. It is an American principle demonstrated in the polls, but not something we should take for granted, which is why, you know, Americans jump to defense of our presidents when they appear to be under assault or, you know, criticism, especially from foreign leaders. Here, I think people cut a lot of slack because they understood why Netanyahu was upset.
But you know what people need to know in our community, and I think this is what they're most curious about when it comes to this whole encounter with Netanyahu and Obama. I think Nixon might be a good example of this, of somebody who, you know, he hated a lot of people, right? But he was able to sort of set those things aside when he felt that something was in the best interest of the United States. That's what people want to know about Obama. Is he able to put away whatever personal rift or tension there might be between him and the Prime Minister of Israel and do what's best for the United States, which all of us think, well, many of us think, in the Jewish world, is a strong relationship with Israel?
I can't tell you because I don't know. And it's very hard to know what people think until they write their memoirs, and then we find out that a lot of things attitudes were not what they necessarily seem, bad and good. I think that the president, many of the issues, felt that all the good things he said were not, you know, acknowledged. But he, as he said in the speech to AIPAC, he knew this line would be controversial, and he did it anyway. He knew that this would get the lion's share of attention. So the question for me is then why not do it as a separate speech or do it at Sunday morning at AIPAC? Why, when you're making a speech about the Arab Spring, which was completely lost, and that message was lost.
Right.
The argument also was that he was doing this in advance of his trip to Europe, where, you know, he's trying to mobilize support against a unilateral declaration, and he felt that this would give him some armament. Others say that this was coordinated with the Europeans beforehand, and you can see some of the statements coming out today. And I mean, Sarkozy's position on the unity is supporting Fatah and Hamas coming together. All the variety of views and positions, but he said that he wanted to be able to show them, and that in the absence of anything happening or the absence of America showing that is taking a position to try and advance the peace, that, you know, he would not have been able to gain their support. Those are all very debatable and will be in evidence, you know, in the coming weeks. The one thing I think that may be misleading for people, because judging by the questions and things that I've heard, is that I don't believe we can stop the unilateral declaration. You can stop perhaps the Europeans and the maybe Canada, Australia, some of the others, and they think that that is a morally an important thing to do.
Well, President Obama told the American people and the world last, when was it? Was it at the AIPAC speech? I think it was during the AIPAC speech that in fact it will be stopped, that in fact they cannot make any progress on that in the UN.
Well, you see, and that, I agree with that, with what you just said, that is the impression. And in fact, and I mentioned this to people in the administration, at most you can get them to postpone it, perhaps,
right,
if enough countries, and if they threaten his aid and they do other things, which should be done on other grounds. And you saw how the members of Congress have all called for cutting off aid to the Palestinians until they, you know, straighten out who they are, what they are, what the role of Hamas is going to be in the PA, etc. But look, I think that there are very clear positions that have come down. But one of the things that is muddled, and there are other issues as well, is whether they can actually stop it. And if you raise expectations and they're not going to be met, then people will say, so what did you do all of that
if
you couldn't stop it anyway?
No question about it. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmn.org. By the way, forget now the commitment by the president about, you know, stopping it for a moment. That aside, did this week say to you that the PA is more prone to go ahead with it, or less prone, or basically the same as it was a week ago?
PA more prone. Very good question. I would say that I don't think there's anything here that is hindering so far their approach. What hinders it more is their internal divisions and the fact that they still haven't reached an accord with between Fatah and Hamas, but I doubt that the international pressure, what we heard was calls by elements, by some of the more extreme elements, you know, saying now this is exactly the time, now you got to put the full force and the pressure. I've seen no diminution in terms of the diplomatic efforts by Palestinians and others to mobilize support for the unilateral declaration. And I think Abbas is going further out on a limb all the time on it.
Right, that's true. I'm confused about the Sarkozy thing you just said. He supports the Fatah Hamas?
He's saying it's important and positive thing. And
a positive development.
Well, because, you know, they're now unified, and they're demanding that they agree to the quartet principles,
right,
which is that you have to recognize Israel, et cetera, et cetera. But we all know that Hamas says we're not going to change, and even if they go into a government, they said, look, the government can take whatever positions they want. We sustain our positions. So it becomes clouded, and it's a standard operating modus for them that you put forward an obfuscated view in order to gain what you can at the moment.
Right.
And then you say, well, I never agreed to it. They still didn't change the charter. They still didn't do other things that they had promised all along to do.
One thing I have to say is that Netanyahu's presentations were absolutely brilliant. I mean, I posted on Facebook. I said, I wish he led the way he speaks, because Friday was unbelievable. The congressional speech was absolutely incredible. And any interview I saw with all the different media sources, I mean, he brings in the history of the Jewish people each time, which we know is so vital, because so many people critically make the mistake of giving the impression that the state of Israel's history begins with the Holocaust, right? So he goes ahead and emphasizes that point every single time, which is so critical. Even his reaction to the heckler, you know, everybody, you knew what was coming. You knew the freedom of speech, thank God for this country, was coming. But then he follows it up with this brilliant line about what does or doesn't happen in Tripoli and what does and doesn't. I'm sorry?
And Tehran.
And did he say Tehran? I think
it
was
Tehran or Tripoli.
Tehran.
Their parliaments, you couldn't do it.
I'm telling you, brilliant. This guy is an unbelievably seasoned diplomat. Incredible the way that he presents. And, you know,
and as you said, we take for granted that people know what 67 was. Nobody knows what 67
correct
was anymore. When I can't tell you how many.
No one knows who Sharon was.
Who say to me, what is this 67 lines? When I tell them, look, this is the 1949 armistice lines. There's nothing sacred about them. And then you use that as an opportunity to tell them the real history of who had the West Bank for 20 years and never created a Palestinian state. How all of this came about. They look at you in absolute shock. They have no clue.
Right.
And that's the glib nature of the reporting. If you read the newspaper of record or others, you know, you get such a distorted view, and they shift right away. Netanyahu's Cairo speech did not make, not only not the front page, not the bullets, and hardly the story, it hardly even acknowledged the positive reaction and support that he was shown. So why should the people, how would they know unless they listen to this program?
you meant congressional speech, right?
Yes.
Oh, I think you said Cairo speech, but...
No, in his speech in Congress.
Right, in Congress. One person commented to me, it was tongue-in-cheek, but he looked very presidential there. And speaking of the president, you know, one of the... you may say to me, this is way too early to start conjecturing, and... It might be, but hey, this is the nature of the game at this point, and too many people have asked me this question this week. Do we have a greater fear for an Obama second term? We've always been taught, you know, the dangers, quote-unquote, of a second term when you have a lame duck president. Is there any reason to suspect or think one way or the other about putting him back in the White House?
Well, certainly, very early to speculate
right
about what the outcome will be a year from now or what the policy direction will be. I think we have to see, and the summer will be very important because of the run-up, not just to the unilateral declaration. We will see what happened with Fatah Hamas, the changes in the Middle East, the ongoing policy, and again, noting the positive highlights, which Netanyahu spoke about, and especially in the military and other areas that are extremely important for Israel and very positive. But the political silly season is on, and we will see. Obviously, it's an issue on people's minds, and many people ask me the same question. And it's understandable that this is a concern, and people look ahead. They always, you know, people look always at a second-term president and say, oh, there are going to be different things. And the tendency is, look, you have Congress, you have checks and balances, And I don't think presidents really change that much in a second term. But that is not to say that their concern isn't out there. And we see it in the reports about fundraising for the Democrats. We see it in other reports
right. That
have been rampant in the press.
You know, with the Jewish people, they're always looking way back or way forward.
But today, not my business.
It's never about what's happening right now. Yeah, what did you think when you saw that some of the I just saw the Saban statements. He was a big supporter of Obama the first time around, and now he's hesitating to put more money into the Democratic Party. So what did you think when you heard about that, the desire to curtail the financial commitment?
I don't think he was an enthusiastic supporter the first round. He was a very enthusiastic and generous supporter of the Clintons, but he was... I think more hesitant on Obama, and that this announcement has focused attention again on the subject. But he's not the first one to say it. And I was quoted in the journal saying that I think people. What I hear is that people are holding back, waiting to see. They want to see who the Republicans will put up. And I think this time, who he's running against will prove to be much more important than sometimes in elections. That. People will judge the president as the president, but they have to have somebody else to vote for. And right now it's so unclear who could emerge that I think people are just sitting back and assessing, you know, what they want to do and where, if they will give and where they will give.
One other comment I want to add regarding the what you said regarding the Jewish media and some of the reaction. And you mentioned some of the polls, but... Enthusiastically, it seems, based on the numbers, enthusiastically, Jews around the world, including Israel, because I can just imagine what the Israeli media is doing with this whole week, we're thrilled with what Netanyahu did. At least that's based on what I saw. In fact, one of the polls said that is Obama a friend of Israel or is he a reliable peace broker for Israel? I think it was 12%. Felt that was obviously, but the media does not reflect that at all. And that's why I say, and I know you made this point before about the Jewish media, but, even more so compared to the regular media, the Jewish media has got to be more responsible with this and reflect what's really happening out there.
That's exactly the point. It's a question of responsibility, and that we've seen this tilt towards ideological positioning, which they criticize on the part of others. But you're right. There was a poll in Israel that showed that 12% of Israeli Jews considered President Obama pro-Israel. 40% said pro-Palestinian. I think 34% were neutral. Remember that his numbers, it's not a decrease. It's where he was. In fact, he was even lower in the polls at some points. Second, there was a poll that showed that almost 50% of Israelis thought his trip was a great success. I think that 10% said it wasn't, that it was a failure. And this despite the headlines in Israel that it was a failure, a disaster, et cetera, on the part of a lot of the critics. And in some cases, he at one point blamed the press, so they all wrote then negative articles because they were angry at him. And again, it's because I value free press and because I think it's important to educate and because I think there's a responsibility that we have to all of us have to think about what we say and how we say and think of the longer-term implications. Those who issued, condemnations of the president, people who write these terrible things, and take the extreme on the other side, are wrong also. And that's why I said it was so important to sit back one time and just look at what's happening. For all those, who are so down and critical, to think about how the Congress of the United States saluted the state of Israel, beyond just the prime minister,
yeah. And
reflected a feeling that is remarkable in this country. Look at the numbers in Europe. Look, could this happen in any parliament in Europe today?
Absolutely not. You got to be careful. If things go to the extreme, you may have one day where people firebomb people's houses because they don't agree with things that are going on. You got to be very, very careful.
Never.
Malcolm, one other thing on this. When the prime minister in Congress said that... people should come visit the Knesset if they want to see an active dialogue, so to speak. I don't remember the exact quote, but I think you remember what I'm referring to, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember what he said? I thought when he mentioned the freedom of the press and the list of things that we enjoy here in the United States, that we enjoy in the United States and Israel. I thought he would say something like, "And if you want to see freedom of the press, see, take a look at the shots that they're doing, that they're aiming at me every single day in the Israeli media." But whatever.
Well, he said that if you think your debates are raucous, right, compared to the Knesset, and they all laugh because all of them
they know about it,
know
right?
the reputation of the Knesset.
Oh, it's so true. I hate to get off topic, but again, one of those things I want to make sure to get to because it seems that people have focused on it this week. Shechita in Holland, Bris Mila in San Francisco. Anything to panic about, or is this the usual, you know, these issues come up every once in a while?
Well, I do think they're matters of concern, and the it's not just San Francisco. I think Santa Monica now is joining, and others getting into this issue, which is, I don't think, will stay in the test in the Supreme Court or should even pass muster in any legislative or judicial body.
So that's the fail-safe.
In terms of interference. But the people who use these issues, not everybody, some may have legitimate concerns, but right. by and large, as has traditionally been used as a means of attacking the Jewish community, certainly the Shechita in Holland and in other parts of Europe. While there are some who express concerns about humanitarian issues treatment of animals, the fact is they don't manifest it in many other ways, and this is an issue which has been used, and people should know, should be a red flag when it comes up in not just there, I think in Sweden and other countries where the Shechita issue is coming to the fore.
Right. All right, so that was important.
That out of love for the Jewish people.
Yaakov Solomon was here this week, and he said that oftentimes when people ask questions, they don't want the answer. And it's sort of what you just said, that, you know, this is not for many people, it's not a sincere effort, you know, with benevolent intentions in mind. It's simply, you know, a way to start up with the Jewish people. I mean, with some people. Right? Okay. You were in the room when the Prime Minister spoke at, you were in the room when the President of the United States spoke at AIPAC?
No, I was not.
Now,
I heard him.
There was great, I heard it live. There was great concern about the reception he'd get, and the reception was remarkable. I mean, I didn't hear any booing or anything like that. Am I right?
There were a few people, very few, who booed. The attendance was huge, as you know, this year. They had the largest ever, which is, again, an important statement. And many non-Jews, by the way, and many religious Jews, many Jews of every stripe.
A lot of students.
Synagogues, Reform Orthodox Conservative synagogues came as groups.
A lot of students.
About 1,500 students, about over 10,000 people altogether. Two-thirds of the Congress showing up at the dinner. The President speaking, Prime Minister, the leaders of both House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats alike, giving amazing speeches. Harry Reid's speech on Monday night was a classic, and people should read it. He's the Democratic leader in the Senate, and Boehner, the Speaker of the House also, and Eric Cantor's speech got a raucous reception, and that's the point. When you watch it on television, they gave a warm response, they applauded the President on things that he said, but if you compare it then to listening to some of the reactions to some of the other speakers, you see that it wasn't quite as it appeared on television and as I saw it watching on a computer.
Right. Oh, good point. When you hear the President of the United States at AIPAC basically say, I don't remember the quote, I wish I had it in front of me, but basically say, we are going to guarantee that Iran will not secure nuclear weapons or the ability to, you know, complete their nuclear weapons building. Do you roll your eyes? Do you say to yourself, you know, you're not, you're doing differently than what you're saying?
No. First of all, there's value in the declaration. One of the things that the Iranians will affect their actions, and we'll talk about them for a minute here, because there is a lot going on there that has been eclipsed by the other discussions, and we lose sight of a very vital issue, and there were really a major developments from the Bushehr reactor coming online to the Natanz after the Stuxnet coming back online and producing enriched uranium, even if at a slower rate. The split between Khamenei and Ahmadinejad getting worse and could well intensify and have broad ramifications about the future of Iran. The explosion at the oil refinery, the huge oil refinery, as Ahmadinejad was about to visit there. The findings of the International Atomic Energy Agency regarding confirming that they have found nuclear weapons triggers. and asserting that the reasserting that Iran has a clandestine nuclear weapons program, the Iran's rocket bases in Venezuela that people found, the huge number of executions this week, and the Iranian press is acknowledging almost 200, 180, when the real number, according to groups there, is in fact much larger. All these things just in the past week. So when it's important when the president says what he said, that the marker be put down, that we will prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. It's very important because it's the credibility, it's the word, the message that the Iranians get, that this issue is not behind us, because there are people who are saying, including an Israeli security official, former one, who said, well, it's not an option, they can't do it in the military. But if you take that off the table, and Netanyahu made this point, and other speakers, leaders of Congress made this point, that they have to understand that there is a real military option and that people would be ready to deal with it. And that's why I mentioned the exercise over the Red Sea, which people can interpret as they want. But when people practice bombing runs and things like that together, U.S. and Israel, it does send a message. And, you know, we have a lot of agendas with Iran, the continuing weapons supplies to Hamas and Hezbollah. Gates this week, the Secretary of Defense, said that Hezbollah has more weapons, more rockets than most countries. And concentrated in an area facing Israel. So number one, we can't allow, as much as we may enjoy all being armchair analysts of this one wink at that, or what every dissecting every line, not to lose sight also of some of the big issues that we're addressing. So I think when the president says it, it's very important, because if he didn't say it, it would be a very negative message.
Right. So it's not a hollow decree. There is potential there.
The president says it, and he said it with definitive way. He didn't say, we will try. He said, we will prevent.
If the United States has friends in the Middle East that they could depend on when it comes to, I mean, and, you know, not just Israel, but others as well, when it comes to the need, you know, for practice runs and military space, et cetera, do they need the same thing in South America now? Does the United States have a friend where they can, you know, help build up some type of military presence, or at least, you know, be prepared in case something happens from down south?
It's actually a very interesting question, and one that I had discussions about this week with people who are urging us to pay more attention. As you know, this has been my pet peeve going back to the Bush administration and earlier, that they failed to pay attention, and that all of this was evident about the Iranian investment there and how much they were building up. And now people are looking at it and seeing that Brazil, for instance, is enhancing its ties with Iran and appearing to be shifting a little bit. Argentina, even worse, and maybe even doing economic deals because they have financial problems, so they get paid off. We know that, if you remember the reports, that Chavez was sending millions of dollars to her for the president's election campaign,
right,
in the last election. So when we look at South America today, Colombia is an ally. Panama is a strong ally. If you look at the rest, there are countries that are in the middle, they're neutral, there are a lot on the negative side. And it's spreading, and their influence is spreading. And now, if they are in fact putting these missile bases in, et cetera, these are short-range missiles. The sites that have been noticed are 20 meters deep. This is just an escalation of the threat. But we know that the Iranian presence through Hezbollah reaches to the Mexican coast with the United States, border with the United States.
So who can we most depend on that continent?
That's a very good question. And I think you see the independent line that Brazil has taken, a little bit less than under President Lula. It's a little bit better, but not good. And with the economic growth, and it's become a powerhouse, you know, one of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, China, et cetera, India, as an emerging power, economic power. What happens in South America is very important.
Maybe we'll have to build up the military presence near Guantanamo.
Well, but a lot of this will have to do with our capacity to field through the Navy. It'll be Navy deployment largely, as well as hope it doesn't come to any of this.
Right.
But, you know, it's our backyard.
Oh, yeah. World is getting scary, that's for sure. By the way, an emailer points out that on the positive end in terms of press coverage, and I'm singling out the Ated Neman because they print the transcript of this conversation each and every week, they are among the select few that instead of instead of emphasizing the negative in situations that we discussed this morning, emphasize the positives. I'm giving them a special shout-out this morning, Malcolm. I'm sure you agree with me.
Yeah, but I think it's important that what we're saying is not to ignore the critical parts of this. There were many things there that are of great concern and will be of concern, and what the president says matters. And when he puts down some of these markers, you know, in the same way that when the settlement freeze issue became an obstacle to anything in the Middle East, any progress or all the things they're talking about, because Abbas said, I can't say less. So once the president says 67, and it is the first time that formulation
right.
was used. A lot of people
right.
say other presidents used it. It was
and prime ministers, people are saying.
And yes, but it wasn't used in that way.
Right.
We go back to 67, and the nuance of the difference is very important. So when people are dismissive and say, well, there's nothing new in it, it is, and it's a message now that Abbas will say, look, he said we start negotiating at the 67
right.
line with swaps. Swaps were intended to address the issue of the settlement blocks that would be kept.
Right. All right, we're way over time, but people need to know the answer to this, and that is the process now completely dead without Abbas's, with his alliance with Hamas, without his recognition, or at least without Hamas's recognition of the State of Israel and its right to exist, and with what happened this week in Washington, is it basically all stalled for now? Is there not going to be any type of dialogue between the two parties at this point?
There will be a lot of pressure to move it, but if the president also acknowledged that Israel has legitimate concerns and said that they should not be asked to negotiate with a party that doesn't recognize it, says they're going to destroy it, and put the onus on that onto Abbas. But there are a lot of factors. What role will Egypt play? Will Egypt pressure, as Mubarak would have, Abbas? But now you have a new government that is saying, number one, they're opening up the Gaza crossings. They are, by the way, there was an Egyptian Nazi party launched in Cairo this week. They're in the throes of an election where people are expressing themselves in more extreme ways.
And from Muslims?
Pardon me?
Members of the Islamic faith Nazi party?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it was announced officially, and I think that they said that starting Sunday, the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza would be opened most of the day, and this is part of their effort to end the divisions amongst the Palestinians and to foster the reconciliation, which means that this is something they promised Hamas when they got him to make the deal with Abbas. The deal is not final, and most analysts that I speak to, and even Israelis, think that it's never going to go very far. But the very fact that it is today is an unacceptable situation, with Abbas saying, I'm ready to give up all the U.S. aid, because Congress has been very clear that they are not going to approve additional aid to and continue the aid to the Palestinian Authority if Hamas is part of the government. I think the administration would be there as well on that.
All right, we got to go. A week from Sunday, folks, up Fifth Avenue. If you think you have a legitimate excuse not to be at the parade, the only way you could be excused is if you have a note from Malcolm Hoenlein, right, Malcolm? That's how you spend next Friday, basically.
There are no excused absences.
There's no excused absences.
Well, maybe
literally.
A few.
What is it?
Maybe a few.
But the only way to...
If you go on Aliyah, you don't have to show up.
Ah, there you go. That's a good one. So, in fact, if you want to get an excused absence or find out if you have a legitimate excuse, you got to be in touch with Malcolm. Otherwise, we expect you up Fifth Avenue to celebrate Israel, to salute Israel, and to be there at a critical time to show love and the bond between the United States and the State of Israel. Malcolm, thanks for joining us.
And may I just say one thing? First, there's a great video from the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs about 67 lines, and it's online. It's really remarkable. It shows how the border shifted. It's very short, quite remarkable.
And
the other thing is, I wanted to extend condolences to Rabbi Frankel. Yossi Frankel's mother was nisteret last night, and the Levi is this morning. And I know many people from B'nai Shalom Zalman listen to the show, so I wanted to mention it and to express our condolences.
All right. Our best to the family under these circumstances. Thank you, Malcolm. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak next week. Malcolm Hoenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We call it the Weekly Update.